defense and defense of property claim, I'm not sure that you could carve out a sufficient amendment for that. It would add extra elements to the crime. It would be sort of like the hearsay rule where the exceptions consume the rule.
Yeah, I guess I am comfortable with the whole concept of murder in the second degree, which is you're punished for creating an array of circumstances that are somewhat foreseeable, except I draw the line at it's not foreseeable for then somebody else not related to you to then go commit a crime, an illegal act that then you get held responsible for. So that's where I'm...
Foreseeability is usually confined to conspiracy statutes.
Yeah.
And there's no foreseeability clause in this murder in the second degree statute.
Right. I think I'm going to... I'll probably end up offering that amendment. Let me just ask you... There's one other one. I'm looking at this. Let's see. I'm looking at section 12. I can discuss that one with the other committee members. I guess.
An idea to Representative Guerra. Sydney, first I want to give you the fax number here to my office and by extension House Judiciary. It's 465-6592. And if you have any of your points that you made written, we'd be happy to include them as part of the record. And then secondly, what I'm going to do with this bill, House Bill 244, is I am going to set it aside to try to get through the other two bills we have briefly. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to discuss with my committee members. I wanted to do it Saturday, but I know there are two people gone for sure. So I'm thinking about Tuesday, adding a meeting that will be just exclusively devoted to House Bill 244. Because what's happening is it's a very complex bill, and it keeps pushing other bills down on the schedule that need to get out. And obviously it's important, and we need to get it going. So I'm thinking, leaning toward Tuesday from 3 to whenever we can get it done. I mean, maybe even order pizza or something. But people let me know what their schedule is. And so that's what I'm going to do. I apologize, Barbara. You'll definitely be the first up when we have this hearing, and Vanessa in my office will be in touch with you to let you know what day we're looking at doing this so that it accommodates your schedule as well, okay? And so with that, I'm going to set it aside. That way it gives members time also to work on amendments and to confer with their people and all this other. Representative Guerra.
Thanks. Sid, just and actually Barbara and actually anybody, my guess is this bill is going to end up moving. And so to the extent folks have actually specific amendment language, that would be very useful. And I guess that's it.
So. Madam Chair.
Representative Groomberg.
Yeah, it would help for all the people online if they have some concerns and they provide the committee members in advance proposed amendment language. Maybe that could be done through our famous Vanessa Tondini.
She is famous.
But then we could look and see, you know, exactly the language you guys would like.
Okay, with that, well, sure. Representative Ogg.
We should continue that thought process to members of the committee also, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Good idea.
Absolutely. And there are, you've had some amendments distributed to you today.
These are from.
Yes, the two that are the stapled one and the one right next to it have been given to me by the department.
This is Department of Law.
Of Law. And they're just ideas based upon concerns that we have. And then this one.
I'm sorry, which is, you said the stapled one and the one next to it.
Four total, one by Representative Samuels.
Sorry. Four total, one by Representative Samuels and the other three Department of Law through me. And the one by Representative Samuels, just so you can distinguish, starts page 8 after line 18 it amends section 15. It's actually a new thing.
Madam Chair, I would recommend you have Representative Gruenberg address that with Vanessa after the meeting because of for
this
the
record. Yours.
Yeah. So okay.
These are all
Department of Law. Okay. And look at those with an eye toward do they resolve some of the concerns that we had. Susan just brought them up as potential solutions. So let's look those over. So my tentative plan is Tuesday, 3 to whenever. Okay? So with that, we have set House Bill 244 to the side, and that brings House Bill 517 before us. And Representative Anderson, would you like me to get to Meredith?
No, I'll go first. Okay. Thanks, Madam Chair. House Bill 517 will permit an investment management or custody account with a trust company or a trust division of a bank with the trust powers to have a beneficiary designation take effect upon death of the owner. And so the members of the committee understand, under current law, securities and brokerage accounts may have the beneficiary designation currently, and that takes effect upon the death of someone pursuant to the Uniform Transfer on Death, or TOD, Security Registration Act. However, and the reason I sponsor this legislation, the current definition in Alaska statute of security account in the Uniform Act is not broad enough to include investment management or custody accounts, which are generally used by trust departments. So Wells Fargo came to me and they said, would you please sponsor House Bill 517 so we can clarify this? And the bill will now allow for these products to avoid probate and expedite that process by providing a statutory authorization, obviously, in the language you can read that, to use a beneficiary designation. It will also put bank trust departments on an equal footing with brokerage firms, and I think this is important. The problem can't be solved other than by statute, and just so the members know, oftentimes the question's asked what other states are doing this, and in the last 3 years, California, Idaho, Iowa, Minnesota, and Washington are a few examples of states that have enacted similar legislation. I have asked Maribeth Conway, as the chair has stated, who is on line right now from Wells Fargo Trust Department, to be here to answer questions, and maybe I hope she maybe has some comments as well if she wants to add to what I've stated, and she can talk about how this would affect trust departments if not enacted. Also, I would point to the letters of support in your packets from Wells Fargo, of course, and from the Alaska Bankers Association.
Okay, thank you, Representative Anderson.
I just concluded that there are letters of support in the packet from the Bankers Association, Wells Fargo, and Mary Beth's online, and I would hope that rather than just answer questions, she can just add to, if this bill isn't passed, what the problem is.
Okay. Mary Beth Conway, are you there? Thanks for your patience. You probably learned more about the criminal code than you wanted to.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am here. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, representatives. For the record, my name is Mary Beth Conway. I am the trust manager for Wells Fargo in Alaska. I've been an attorney in private practice and also a securities licensed financial consultant with a brokerage firm. And I'm pleased to have the opportunity to testify you today. Representative Anderson indicated a great overview of what truly is a very straightforward, simple, and technical change to the Alaska Transfer on Death Law. It's my understanding that the Alaska Transfer on Death statute is very similar to the law in other states. It was initially drafted as a uniform state law and subsequently adopted by our state. It's my understanding that the statute really focused at the time by the drafters on accounts offered by brokerages and other financial institutions, since it's generally assumed that bank accounts fall under another statute. However, bank trust departments and trust companies do have investment management and custody accounts that are not included in the statutory definition of security account. So currently, securities and brokerage accounts can have a specified beneficiary designation that takes effect upon the death of the owner. It's a concept that's very similar to a beneficiary designation form used for life insurance policies or on a retirement account such as an IRA. This means the assets of the accounts pass automatically to the beneficiary on the death of the owner without having to go through probate. Our belief is that our customers do expect that investment management and custody accounts would be handled the same way as a very similar account would be treated at a brokerage firm. This is a bill that would make it possible for us to meet our customer expectations. Without the changes that are afforded in the bill, these investment management and custody accounts, held either with a trust company here in our state or a trust division of a bank with trust powers, must go through probate. So it allows for very simple treatment for families to provide for beneficiary designation. It truly clarifies the technical definition of security account. As Representative Anderson said, it puts the same types of accounts that are simply held with different companies on equal footing with respect to transfer on death. And it's very similar, this change, to statutes that were recently enacted within the last few years in other states. And it's our understanding that these changes were non-controversial, customers haven't experienced problems, and it facilitated post-death transfers of assets. For these reasons, we would appreciate your support in passing House Bill 517. And thank you, Madam Chair. That concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, apparently the sponsor has a question for you.
Well, Mary Beth, before we have committee members, thank you for the testimony. This should be a short and sweet bill to the committee here, I hope. But just can you, for the members' understanding, can you give a quick example of what this bill will alleviate, just in simple terms? You somewhat touched on it, but just so people who may not understand trusts or other things, you know, when you state here, I was writing notes and you said investment management or custody accounts. Just give a simple example of what that is and how this bill will expedite the process using, like, let's say, husband and wife.
Certainly. It's very common for individuals, we have many customers who have accounts through our trust department here at Wells Fargo that are not trust accounts. They are simply investment management accounts. You can actually hire a bank trust department or a trust company to manage money as an individual, just like you could hire somebody at Smith Barney or Merrill Lynch or another brokerage firm. Those brokerage firm account forms allow for a customer, such as a father who might want to identify a transfer on death to his children, can actually put that on the brokerage account form. Whereas if that dad had the same type of investment management account through a bank trust department or a trust company here in Alaska, there is no ability to designate within our records that type of transfer upon the dad's death. So it's the same type of an account. Representative, does that answer your question?
Yep, that's a perfect example. Thank you.
Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry I was out of the office out of the room for just a minute. I missed some of what Representative Anderson said. I'm looking at, do you have a copy of the current act in front of you, ma'am?
Yes, I do.
Okay, I'd like you to look at the very last word in the whole act. It's AS 13.33.310B3. And it has the initials LDPS. What does that stand for?
Representative, pardon me. I actually don't have a complete act, I see.
Okay, well, what it says, it said multiple owners, primary and secondary, substituted beneficiaries. And one example is John S. Brown, Mary B. Brown, JT10TOD, which stands for joint tenancies, I assume, transferred on death. John S. Brown, Jr., LDPS.
I'm not sure.
Okay. Second question. This just puts bank-managed accounts on the same footing as brokerage-managed accounts, right?
That is correct.
This was a uniform act. I see it's the Uniform Transfer on Death Security Registration Act. Normally, when we pass a uniform act, we have a short title that says this act may be cited as, in this case, the Uniform Transfer on Death Security Registration Act. This doesn't contain that common title, which means to me that this must differ significantly from the Uniform Act. Am I right?
Representative, actually, I believe when the statute was originally adopted, that it was the Model Transfer on Death statute was adopted primarily in whole. Why it was not titled as such, I don't have any information.
And finally, since it apparently, I mean, at least it's titled the Uniform Transfer on Death, it's an article, I'm wondering if the language that you're planning to include here is language that's in the Uniform Act, or have other states adopted it? And I'm sorry if there was testimony on this already and I missed it.
And Mary Beth, this is Representative Anderson through the chair. I, just for edification for Representative Bloomberg, I stated that over the last several years, similar legislation has passed in California, Idaho, Iowa, Minnesota, and Washington, and there's several other states pending.
So this is a trend here. And finally, on line 8 of the bill, we have the term cash equivalents. That's page 2, of course. And the same with page 2, line 20. What are cash equivalents?
That would be a money market type of an account, something that is liquid but is not cash, typically a money market investment fund.
Okay, that's great. Thank you.
Okay, any further questions for Mary Beth? Anybody else online that wishes to testify on this very controversial bill, House Bill 517? Or here in the audience? Hearing none, public testimony is closed. Is there any further committee discussion?
Madam Chair.
Representative Garrett.
Yep.
I thought you were going to move the bill.
Yeah, I will.
I did too.
Got me excited.
The bill. I am sitting here right now, and I still have like the vaguest understanding of what this bill does. So, Representative Anderson, can you just...
Okay, no problem, through the chair. Did you miss what she stated about how you can go to a Merrill Lynch or a... Charles Schwab, and if you designate on a form when you make these investments, stocks, whatever they may be, that your beneficiary is your son, and the fairly simple transfer through probate, whereas if you go through Wells Fargo and you say I want to invest, and it's becoming more and more popular for investment and financial counseling at banks now for investment purposes, you go to Wells Fargo and you invest money and tied it with trust or not, what Mary Beth and why Wells Fargo came to me testified to is that if you die, there isn't that simple transfer, and it can be more complicated without that ability by statute for there to be a direct beneficiary designation. And so called legal services to have the bill drafted and said, what would this and what should this include? And they said, well, first, let's make sure there's definitions, and that's what's on page 1, so we understand what we're talking about. Representative Gruenberg referenced cash equivalents, which is just money markets, which you can get at Wells Fargo or many other banks now in Alaska. And then they added on basically kind of a definition and an example, not an example, but I would say a definition of what type of accounts we're talking about that are not security and brokerage accounts. So that would be the investment management account or custody account with a trust company or trust division of a bank. And then that includes securities, cashes, cash balances, and cash equivalents or interest and earnings, meaning money markets. So it's really pretty straightforward. I mean, that's where I wouldn't have sponsored the bill. I mean, it wasn't that technical. And that's what we limit it to. And I don't know why Representative Gruberg's question, if you weren't here, was simply what the title seems fairly long, but I think it's because... fairly, the titles and the names of these different things can be complicated, and there's a difference between an investment management or custody account and a security or brokerage account. Security and brokerage account under like a Merrill Lynch is covered. You sign on, I want the money to go here, there, everywhere, but that doesn't happen with investment management custody accounts, and so we're changing that like these other 5 states have over the last couple years.
I understand that. The problem with the bill, and I think it's fine, the problem with the reason why the bill is hard to understand is all the bill is a definition section. Right?
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Somewhat.
So,
yeah.
So there's no part of the bill that says what the bill does.
Yeah.
There's just the part that does definitions.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, it just adds that. And I think Mary Beth didn't draft it, legal services did, but that was our intent, was simply what she testified to.
Representative Gruenberg?
Yeah. And I grabbed the bill, I mean the act itself, because I didn't know. It's called the Uniform Transfer on Death Security Registration Act. And what it allows you to do is to register your security, and Mary Beth, if you correct me if I'm wrong on this, it allows somebody to simplify a transfer at the time of death and to avoid probate by setting up what's usually a POD or a TOD account. A POD means pay on death, and that's for money. A TOD is transfer on death, and that usually is securities, and I happen to have one with my wife. It's a great idea, and I recommend it for anybody who is in that situation. And it simply means that upon your death, the assets in the account go to the beneficiary. And you can even have it so that it's a joint account and payable to somebody else or transferable to somebody else. Or you can have it so you have primary and secondary beneficiaries. And it's very simple, and it's very good as far as our family goes. Am I incorrect in what I've said, ma'am?
No, sir.
Representative Kira.
Yeah, no, thanks. That's actually what I was looking for, so I appreciate it.
And I've got it here if anybody wants to read it.
Representative Kira, do you have a motion?
As a minority member, I really don't know how to make the motion.
We're going to give you a chance to start learning.
I move that we strike HB 472 from...
That motion is out of order, Representative Kira.
Mary Beth, that's our medical malpractice bill.
Representative Garrett, try it again.
I move HB 517 with zero fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Is there any objection to that finely stated motion? Hearing none, House Bill 517 is moved.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mary Beth has committed that when Representative Guerra goes to Wells Fargo, there will be many a lollipop for him, an expedited service.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mary Beth. Okay, that brings us to House Bill 533 by Representative Weirach. Representative Weirach, join us.
Thanks, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is a bill that was introduced by the State Affairs Committee. Is there a...
I just got handed it. Out of the press. CS is forthcoming here.
May I have a copy?
Sure, yep. I'm sorry. Dave just got it to me.
And as soon as you get it, Representative Samuels, you want to make a motion to adopt this new CS?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that we adopt the CS for HB 533 /D version.
Is there an objection to that motion? Hearing none, we have version D before us. Representative Weirach.
Briefly go through what the differences are between the CS and the original bill. On page 2, line 12, the word immediate has been replaced for significant. And then same page, section B, the second full sentence is added on section B. That's what the CS adds to this. That's what's different between the original. And these are really good amendments. But generally, let me tell you the policy behind the bill. The bill is introduced in the Senate. The policy behind the bill is to, for those individuals who are in front of an administrative law judge, pending a decision by an administrative law judge in front of an agency or appealing some decision by an agency, many times have their decision under advisement for a long time. And sometimes it goes on and on and on, and sometimes it goes on to years. Sometimes it goes to decades. And it's actually quite frustrating for the public that has a permit or a decision within the purview of an agency hearing officer and no decision has been reached. This would allow the person who is in that situation to repair to a court to ask the court to either enjoin the agency to issue a decision sooner rather than later, or take some other remedial step that would essentially, in lay term, goose the decision maker in the agency to a final decision that can either be accepted by the public or then appealed to the Superior Court and then the Alaska Supreme Court, and if possible, necessary, to the United States Supreme Court. But that is essentially the policy reason behind the bill. it does require the person to notify the agency, look, if you don't move, we're gonna go to a court. So give us a reason why you're not going to rule on this. What is it? When you close the record, there's no need for additional evidentiary findings. You've had an advisement. And I think it's worthwhile for the court to know that if you go to a court, and let's say you just have a simple summary judgment action. You go to a court, you file a summary judgment, there's an opposition and a reply. Then the court holds oral argument. At that point, the case is taken under advisement, and the record is closed. And 6 months from that day, the court has to, at least as I understand it, this is right, 6 months from the day that case goes under advisement, the court has to rule or their checks are withheld. I wanted to actually put that in this, because sometimes it's very frustrating for people who are paid by the government to issue a decision. They get paid whether they're playing solitaire on a computer or issuing a decision or doing any work. And it's very frustrating for the lay public to be subjected to that just holding pattern on and on and on. Now, that's not to say that all hearing officers act that way or all agency officials do this and that this is going to be handled in all cases. I don't want to paint with such a broad brush. But there are instances where it's very frustrating for the public to understand what's going on. So I actually wanted a more hold the paycheck kind of hammer, but I was held back.
Strained.
I'm finding that. I'm going to find this.
Representative Wyrick, there'll be questions for you from a bunch of people. What about the case? It doesn't look like it's dealt with in this bill. Representative Ogg brought up a point when we dealt with the central hearing officer panel that sometimes it's, in point of fact, the petitioner that continues to file appeals to delay the process because it's not to their benefit to get an ultimate result. And I think the example you used was in the commercial
CFEC.
So it's sort of out of the purview of your bill, but I think we've identified at least two places where the system can break down with respect to that timing, and certainly part of it is what you're addressing. What about the case of the petitioner who continues to tie up the process and abuse it?
There are instances where someone would file an appeal and they want a delay and they don't want a decision ever to issue. They don't have to act under this bill. They can sit there and let that thing pinned for their lifetime. Then their heirs can be subjected to that, and their heirs' heirs. There's no requirement that they repair to a court to force a decision maker in an agency. And I know that with respect to the CFEC, the longer the pending permit is under advisement, the longer the person has an interim permit and the longer they can continue to fish. And somebody with 0 points towards a permit, it's in their interest to have it drug out in the system for a long time. They don't have to take advantage of this. But for those, for example, the case in the CFEC, let's say there's a case where a fisherman was a young man and filed a claim for points. The hearing officer delayed, and the hearing officer heard testimony. The hearing officer gathered evidence. The hearing officer took it under advisement and then didn't issue a permit. So that CFEC permit decision is in the process. That permit holder can fish every single year. And if they even get sick or have a stroke, they can medically transfer that interim permit year after year. So there's no harm, no foul. Now that permit holder, 30 years later, is dying. Now that permit holder, instead of being a young man or even being able to medically transfer, wants to know, and their heirs want to know, do I have an asset that I can cash out or devise to my heirs? Or is that going to be some liability they're going to have? How am I going to deal with that? I want to be able to address that. That decision can string all the way out. Even though their rights to fish are still there, they've reached the point of no return. And also, 30 years later, 20 years later, after that agency's had the case under advisement, you don't get the permit because this witness testified this way and these facts aren't there. 25 years later, once you get a decision, how are you supposed to go back and interview any other witnesses and gather any other evidence that may bolster your support that this hearing officer erred? When either witnesses, I can't remember what happened 25 years later. The witnesses are dead. The evidence is gone. Now that person potentially has a claim for denial of due process because they didn't have a timely decision, so they can gather the evidence and for the hearing officer to make a decision. So I understand the case where CFEC, it's in their interest to drag it on, but this doesn't require it. It's only a remedy.
Representative Samuels, Garrett, and then Ogg.
Thank you. Madam Chair, when you getting back to your paycheck scenario, did you have language drafted to?
Oh, this is when the brainstorm session came out. I just felt that I didn't hear hands, or I didn't see hands. I didn't, you know. No, I didn't.
Hey, the court system will end up having the same problem. That, I mean, you can go to the, you know, to the Supreme Court, and, you know, one judge gets it, if he doesn't get it done in 6 months, supposedly he has to hand it off to the next justice, to the next justice, to the next justice, to the next justice, year after year after year of being the handoff. So I was interested if you had language.
The administrative context?
Court system or
well
in this too, then if there's ways to fix that without, you know, obviously without, you don't want somebody to have to make a decision in a week, but
right, no,
the,
I didn't,
the hammer's not there.
I didn't look at that in this context. I certainly did not want to look at it with respect to the judiciary, and partly even with, and where the where it's more loose in terms of deadlines is in the Alaska Supreme Court, and from everything I've heard from their state of the judiciary speeches to the legislature, they are trying their best to get decisions out in a timely manner, and I just didn't want to even go there, partly because I still practice.
On that point, Representative Grunberg?
Yeah, I'm having handed out a typical statute, and this is a statute that is found in the Supreme Court, 2205, Court of Appeals, 2207, Superior Court, 2210, and District Court 2215, and it says a salary warrant, and maybe that'll have to be changed now that we have electronic payments, and actually, we probably should have, maybe they did even amend this. I think they did, they're called salary, whatever they're called.
Salary warrants.
But they're no longer called salary, they're called something else now, but whatever. You can't get paid until you file an affidavit that no matter referred to the judge, judicial officer for opinion or decision has been uncompleted or undecided by that person for a period of more than 6 months. In the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals, which are multi-judge courts, that just means you have to have an opinion circulating within that period of time, which is not particularly the issue here. But the point being that the people don't get paid until that opinion is out. I mean, you know, they have to have an affidavit, and I clerked for a justice, and once in a while he couldn't file that, and so he was a little late getting paid, but it works.
Representative, did you have anything further, Representative Samuels?
On that point,
and then Representative.
You have justices also who have signed the affidavit and had the work that's over 6 months old, gotten paid anyway, and there's no remedy. None.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't know about that, but I would think that a remedy would be with the code, with the Commission on Judicial Conduct, because that's filing a false affidavit, which is certainly against the judicial canons. So I would think there definitely is a remedy for that.
Representative Guerra.
I'm going to start on that point just for a moment. I've had this discussion with Representative Samuels, and there are times where I think the judges have waited too long to issue opinions, but there are also times. Remember, they don't have just one opinion to decide. They have 100 opinions before them. And some of these guys do work weekends and evenings.
Don't sign it.
And I would just say, before we went into that area, we would actually, I think, have to hear from the Supreme Court and just to hear the practicality of their side of the story, too. And I say that having shared the frustration you share a number of times in the past myself. I think the bill is a good idea. There are a couple of concerns I have. One is, I understand this idea of somebody doesn't get a decision in a year or 2 years or 3 years, and that's outrageous. But I also know that once we create this right of saying unreasonable delay, very sophisticated parties are going to start trying to use that to their benefit in the administrative process and just start filing these actions in superior court. And I can think of two ways around that to prevent abuse of the process. One is I would ask you to seriously consider just exempting corporate tax and oil revenue cases. In a billion-dollar case, people are going to try and find any possible advantage they can in the system to get out of paying or to delay paying. And since we haven't heard really evidence in the oil and corporate tax structure of the administrative proceedings being abused, I was wondering whether we might exempt those at least until we hear that there is a problem in that area and then address that separately. I think back to what was the Amerada Hess case. That was a multi-billion-dollar case, and parties on both sides filed every single conceivable piece of paper they could to get an advantage in that case, and I don't want to see that happen. But in the average sort of small administrative case, I agree with you. And so that removes abuse in these very incentive-laden cases by just removing those cases outside of this bill. And then the other question I have is, once we pass this, people are going to start filing these motions in Superior Court. I think we will probably get very, very many of these motions in Superior Court, whether or not well-founded. And if we allow this too liberally, it could sort of delay things further in the court process. I'm wondering if we should say unreasonable delay, but have a minimum amount of time before you could file the relief in court. And you're talking about year delays. I don't know if those are what you have in mind, or if we could have 6 months, 9 months, a year. It doesn't kick in until a certain amount of time has passed, so that people can't start doing it 30 days out and 40 days out and 50 days out. So I guess those are my two concerns.
Representative Weilrock?
Well, has that been handled in the Senate, those issues? I'm asked Mr. Stancliffe if those have been handled in the Senate, but one thing I was curious, you're not, if an oil company or a producer has a tax case in front of an agency, is it in their interest to get an immediate decision, or is it the CFPC kind of case where if the agency has it under advisement, no harm, no foul, they're not being forced to pay any sort of tax, so that the longer that's in the agency hands, they're not really prejudiced. They're not being forced to pay. They're simply maybe putting the money in an escrow account until there is a decision. So there is hard. It's hard to know immediate. It's hard to define immediate and irreparable damage in that case, because there's not an immediate damage because it's pending before an agent, and it's not irreparable because the money that maybe have to be paid in taxes or being set aside in escrow, in the eventuality the administrative agency's decision is affirmed on appeal. So that's hardly seems like an irreparable damage in that case. And to also to put a timeline on these almost is a case-by-case basis. I think that if you have, and that's almost going to be common law kind of a decision. What is the case? What are the facts? What is meant by immediate and irreparable in the context of an agency appeal process by a hearing officer? And when you say it is in CFPC and not for oil and gas, or it is for food stamps or not for another, I think that it's going to be very difficult to set as a state policy in a bill what agencies should issue decisions quickly and which agencies shouldn't. I guess those are my reactions to your point.
Representative Kerr?
I think actually that's a fair reaction to the sort of minimum time period one, and so I'm satisfied that that one's not needed. In the case of the billion-dollar oil tax dispute, I, as an oil company, if I could make the argument in good faith, would say by this money being tied up, I can't engage in further exploration in an area that I need to engage in exploration, or else I might lose a lease or something like that. So they might be able to make a plausible, irreparable case. And what they'll really want to do is, especially if they know they owe the money, they will really want to avoid a decision by the tax court. And there's a provision in here that says you can go to Superior Court and ask for an alternative dispute resolution process. So if I'm Exxon and I know I'm going to lose a case in front of the tax court, I'm going to say, shit, I'm going to try and get the Superior Court to order arbitration.
I know.
Did I say that?
Right there.
Did I say that? Well, that's a Sid Billingsley said that, you know, she is the word nuts, and you know, at Harvard we
meant to just think it, not say it.
So you know you're going to lose the case in front of the tax court. You owe $1 billion, and you want to take a shot at getting the Superior Court to do under this bill to say, okay, you can do it by arbitration instead. And so I think if we just exempted the sort of corporate tax and royalty cases from this.
The intent of the bill is not to provide forum selection alternatives for agreements before an administrative agency. The intent of the bill is to provide a legislative relief valve to goose an agency to issue a decision once it's been pending for an unreasonable length of time. So any lawyer who files a pleading in case that says, we want to have this case move to another proceeding or an alternative forum because we may not like it, even though it's been a short period of time, would be subjected potentially to sanctions for filing an improper pleading posed to delay, as opposed to, in fact, getting an agency to issue a decision to avoid delay. So that's the purpose of the bill, not to provide this kind of forum selection and further delay, but to end delay and get the decision out there so then the courts can address it through the normal course of things and then people can live their lives in an ordered fashion. It's what happens when cases go into the bowels of an agency decision-making process that no one knows what goes on there. You don't know what the hearing officer is doing. The hearing officer sometimes retires. Another one picks it up. It gets transferred to somebody else. They don't know the facts. That person dies. It goes to somebody else. The commissioners then who have to review that go away or get reappointed. The public has to have some opportunity to say, enough. We want a decision in order to live our lives.
Chair, just finally.
Representative Guerin, wrap up?
Yeah. Certainly in the cases where they stretch the arguments under this bill, they could get sanctioned. But, you know, an oil company could have a good faith argument. Complex oil tax issue, it's been 6 months, and they say enough is enough. And they say, I want a decision now, but really they're thinking, I want to see if I can get a chance at a different dispute resolution forum. So they will be sophisticated. They won't file those claims where they're clearly frivolous, so they won't get sanctioned. They'll file the case where their argument is plausible. And I really don't want to, that's just the one area that jumps out at me that I want to exclude from this bill.
Well, I just, again, Representative Garth, through the chair, I think that the key point here is the judicial inquiry that's going to have to take place in this kind of thing. When was the case filed before an administrative agency? How complex was the record? How long has the case been under advisement? Is this the best forum to relitigate this case or send it to another forum? Or do we need time for the administrative agency to cook on this and let's hear from the agency in some sort of an affidavit that they're diligently working on this? And in that way, I'm going to deny this, and I'm going to hold the case under advisement for 6 months from today, and I want a notice from the parties where the case is at that point. If it's still under being delayed at that point, then we'll have another hearing in this court set on for an hour to hear from the agency and the parties about the delay, and then I'll make a decision at that point. So I think it's in the reasonable discretion of a Superior Court judge not to clutter their calendar with these kind of agency appeals, but to leave it to the discretion of the agency and their special expertise, and to let them act on these kind of appeals, but do so in a relatively timely way, not an expeditious way on all appeals. I think that every reasonable judge knows that these agencies are going to have some backlog of cases to deal with, just like they do.
Hey, Representative Ogg?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, Representative Byrock, really appreciate this effort here, the little understanding of administrative law. This gives a nice little escape valve from the pressures of a Dickens novel. I just wish that we had the ability to urge the federal judiciary into such a quick act.
You know, Representative Ogg, Madam Chair, I work with administrative agencies, and it is Kafkaesque that that's the second time I've used that this week, but they say we can't help you have to ask the agency for expedited decision. You do that and it doesn't go anywhere, because if you go to re-court, there is no opportunity in court, so you're left at the mercy of a federal hearing officer to decide what's expeditious or not. So you're right, I agree with you.
Well, people really need to be able to make decisions, as you said. Remember dealing with the regs surrounding shellfish farming. And we had adopted the Aquatic Farm Act in 84 and made it very clear that we wanted to allow that so long as certain things were met, and the act was very clear. And the Department of Fish and Game came back, and I mean, this was in 2002. So it just, I mean, you know, almost 20 years later and still no resolve, and people had finances tied up, and a couple of the folks that came in to testify had planned to do this as a retirement after teaching. And so it really impacts people's lives in a profound way. And I think this is a great tool to have out there, and hopefully it doesn't have to be used often. Hopefully just its mere presence will be enough to push people off the dime. I think it's a great bill. Representative Wyrock, Jandy Young is on the line from Department of Law. And so if it's okay with you, I want to go to her to testify, her or him. And then Dave, did you want to add anything?
I'm just here for questions, and okay. I do have some statistics that might, if I give a little bit of background on that, would give some comfort, because we are building standards, Madam Chair, Dave Stancliffe, Reg Review. We're building standards for the courts to be able to look at, and in what the time frames, a reasonable time frame would be, because there's such a diversity in time frames, some required in statute, some required by federal law, some open-ended. So we're part of what we're doing in Reg Review is building a standard so the courts will have some guidance. So I'm here for questions, basically, Madam Chair.
Fantastic. Okay, without further ado, Jan DeYoung, Department of Law.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. This is Jan DeYoung. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Department of Law, and I currently handle employment and administrative law issues at the department. One of the attorneys in Wake who handles those issues. I also have experience in a previous position for the state as a hearing officer for 7 years in the 90s. I was asked by the department to testify about this bill. I want to thank the committee with the opportunity to make these comments. The Department of Law has been working with the bill sponsors to address some of the department's concerns about the bill. We are pleased to see some of that work incorporated into the committee substitute that I'm looking at here, but I would still like to go through some of those concerns.
Okay.
The department's chief concern in the original bill was the absence of notice to the administrative agency that an individual involved in the was going or was going to go to court to seek a remedy for delay. And so we appreciate the change on page 2 of the bill, which does add the sentence providing the notice to the agency. However, we have recommended a minimum of 30 days before the individual could go to court after providing notice. The reason for that time period, I guess, would be to allow the agency the opportunity to do what Representative Wyrock has called the goose, in other words, to respond to the concern and to, in some cases, maybe for the first time, discover the particular harm being caused for that person by the delay in the hearing, and to be able to, muster or reallocate resources to respond to, genuine problems, and so that the citizen appearing actually gets their decision heard, because, the judicial process isn't going to be very fast, and if they could get a remedy within 30 days, they would be doing probably much better than they could do in any effort to seek assistance from the court. So the 15 days just probably isn't an adequate time to allow the remedy, allow the agency to clean house or clean up its act, if you will. And it's particularly going to be a problem for those agencies whose decision makers are volunteers on boards and commissions, because it can simply take, it could take the entire 15 days just getting in touch and polling those members and trying to get something out, or even longer, especially if we're talking about a holiday period. So we do appreciate the notice, although we think that the opportunity for the agencies to consider and respond to the concerns of the party appearing before them may be too short to be effective. Another point I want to make is we appreciate the substitution of the word immediate for significant, because what that does is it makes the standard, in other words, the kind of harm that the litigant would need to show in order to get court or judicial assistance. That phrase is just one that has been used a lot, the immediate and irreparable harm phrase. So it would provide all of the parties involved in this area with some guidance on what might be required before the courts intervene. So we do appreciate that change that was made. I want to turn now to the actual remedies that the judge would be able to award if it appears that there was unreasonable delay. And, first, enjoining the administrative proceeding and determining the matter, the first one, I guess my suspicion is that would be unusual that the court would want to take that over. But it still remains unclear how the court would substitute itself for the agency. In other words, what procedures would it be following? If there was already a hearing below, would it be just issuing a decision on that hearing record? Would it need to conduct a separate hearing? And in many cases, some of the things that the agencies do, the courts don't have that actual power to substitute for. So we had questions in my department about, how this would play out or the interface between the judge and the administrative agency. The second matter there, where the judge could order an administrative matter to be handled by another form of dispute resolution, was just another remedy that I guess we had a question about how that would work. Normally, alternate dispute resolution is voluntary. Many times the parties agree to share the expenses when they agree to go to an alternate form of dispute resolution, and we're wondering how a compulsory alternate dispute resolution would actually work and who would bear the expense of that process if the court were to order it. I guess another point I want to make is that there are other opportunities, at least for some administrative agencies already, to address concerns about delay. And we have a question about the possible duplication or inconsistencies in some of those remedies. The Administrative Procedures Act, for example, does give the Superior Court the authority to enjoin an administrative action that is beyond the scope of the agency's administrative powers. But it also has the ability to order the administrative agency to act or to initiate action when it is withholding that action. And so at least for the APA, agencies, there is some recourse already in the statute to address some of the concerns that have been raised here in this hearing. And for those agencies who are not subject to the Administrative Procedure Act procedures, a handful of them at least, and we haven't done a survey, but so there may be quite a few, do have in their individual statutes places where sections where delay can be addressed or undue delay can be addressed if a decision is slow in getting out. So I guess if ideally this bill could coordinate maybe and make sure that the remedies somehow fit together and don't overlap. And one comment also on the problems with delay, one of the comments were made is it's not always in the interest of an individual or a non-government party to a proceeding for the proceeding to act quickly, and I thought it's interesting to note, though, that this bill is limited to non-government parties. That's pretty clear in the, I think in the page 3 in the definition section there, that in page 3, the state agency or governmental agency cannot go to court. And oddly enough, and sometimes people forget this, the state and political subdivisions do appear in parties before state agencies. So. Thank you. I appreciate the courtesies that have been afforded us by the bill sponsors to work with them today, and I appreciate the opportunity to be able to make my comments to this committee, and thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Representative Gruenberg.
Yeah, thank you. I'm sorry I've been hopping around here a bit, because I'm trying to get a hold of somebody who's really kind of an expert in this area. He's a practitioner here in Juneau named Bart Rozelle. Maybe a lot of you know him. And he and I served together for many years on the Appellate Rules Advisory Committee for the Supreme Court. There is a section in here that will provide a major change in the appellate rules. And that is the section here at the bottom of page 2, subsection E, top of page 3, that basically makes the judicial decision not to issue an order, and basically keeping the proceeding in the administrative agency a final appealable order. And that is going to have a major effect on the practice of appellate law insofar as this involves appeals from administrative agencies. And I believe, and I'm kind of maybe looking at Mr. Woolover, who's sort of sitting there with his head low, might really involve technically an amendment to one of the appellate rules. And that's a technical thing, but would have to be dealt with in the bill. And I've asked Joe McKinnon to see if Bart's around. I don't know if he could make it up here, but I will ask that we keep the bill until Friday, because this I'd like some advice from somebody who really practices in this area. And I know we dealt with that particular issue several times on the Appellate Rule Advisory Committee. There is one major case that I cannot think of. The real question is, what is a final appealable order from an administrative agency? And that comes up quite often and really is involved with this bill in some way. And I'd have to think it through, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jan, for your testimony. Any further questions? Okay, if not, Mr. Sandcliffe, anything you want to respond to and wrap up, and then we'll hold this over till Friday. Well,
thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of things. We appreciate the Department of Law's suggestions. The 30 days versus the 15, kind of based on the fact that in most administrative communications with the public, the agency reserves 30 days and requires the public to respond within 15. Mm. So in this case, it's kind of a compromise. In the memo they laid out with their concerns, that it was brought out that giving a party an opportunity to approach the agency and say, we're going to exercise this option if you don't get off the dime, will actually not take the agency, shouldn't take the agency 30 days to say, we agree with you, we're going to go to work on this, will you hold off? So I don't think that the argument that that 30 days is needed for a response is necessarily the right way to go. We do agree that the language change, immediate and irreparable, is a good change. On some of the other issues, we don't think that the court system will have a problem interpreting how they want to deal with the dispute at hand. In most cases, and in the other body, it was put on the record by Mr. Woolover that the courts, it's anticipated the courts are going to simply say, we don't necessarily agree that we're going to go over the waterfall here, but we do agree that it's taking a long time. Agency, would you hurry things up? That's probably what's going to happen. But looking at this in the broader picture, knowing that this is in place will change the way agencies do business, and that's the goal. We, in answer to the question of the court rule change, we were careful to instruct our drafters to not include anything in this bill that would require a court rule change. If we need clarification on the record with regard to what Representative Gruenberg is researching, that would be fine. But that was the intent, to not require a court rule change and a three-quarter vote to enact the policy. We'll be glad to come back before you at your discretion, Madam Chair, and if you decide you want to go a different direction on those, the number of days or on any of these points that the Department of Law has brought up, just let us know.
And just a question on that point, you say that's the standard 15 days for the public to respond. Is it 15 business days or just 15 days?
Well, that's interesting because 15 days starts from the time the envelope goes out of their postal system. Okay. And I happen to be a non-attorney representative for a person involved in a workers' comp case that lived in the bush. And the mail always got there, and he had about, in some cases, it didn't get there before the time frame was nearly up. So it actually starts, as I understand it, from the time that they put that into the postal system's hand. They probably have a meter it, and the clock is running. We felt that we met in the middle with the Department of Law and met their primary goals in this compromise. If the committee here just chooses to go further in that, that's your prerogative.
Was there any concern that, not to impugn anybody's motives, but was there any concern that if you do give that much time, the department's already on notice that you're intending to exercise a right that might be threatening, that there might be retribution?
Well, you know, Madam Chair, you would hope that those things didn't occur. I could see where 30 days would be handy for the department to have the time to start to put a case together, knowing they're going to court. I can see that 30 days might be handy for some of the boards or commissions that would have to be polled. But in today's electronic world, 30 days just seems more than that is necessary.
Representative Guerra?
I guess I would think that if your goal is really to send a shot across the bow of the agency and say, I want a decision, if you do 15 days, you're probably going to back them into a corner and make them just get ready for the appeal. And I wonder whether doing 30 days would, in a more complex case, give them time to actually start working on the case and issue a decision. That's the only interesting, maybe negative effect of doing 15 over 30 days. It might slow things down.
That is a consideration, Madam Chairman, and perhaps a legitimate one.
Yeah. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A case came out from the Supreme Court within the last year, which was a very, very unfortunate result, in my opinion. Rule 42C, which deals with the filing of peremptory challenges for judges, reads that the filing of a peremptory challenge is timely if filed before the commencement of trial and within 5 days after notice that the case had been assigned to a specific judge. The Supreme Court came out with a decision. I don't remember the name of the case. Actually, it was in the equivalent criminal rule that that you lost your right if you hadn't actually filed the document in court on that date. What this means in that context is that you're notified, you may be out in the bush or whatever, but your bump of the judge has to be in the clerk's office on that date. It's not enough if you put it in the mail on that date. And this involves somebody like in Anchorage who was trying to file it in the middle of the winter in Valdez. I think it was the Joel Bolger case, Joel being the judge down there. And these people were just out of luck. It was a bad result, but according to the rule. Now, here we have in this bill the term provided the state agency with written notice. That might well be read as having filed the document with the agency on that date, because although they talk about service being, and then there's another rule that says service is complete upon mailing, that's not the providing of the notice, that's the service. And this is a very ambiguous term, and if you want to say they must have mailed the thing, then you want to say have mailed the notice on that date, postmark. So there's no question, otherwise you're going to have very unfortunate results. That's number one. And number two, the issue was where you said you didn't want, and I'm talking to Mr. Stancliffe here, through the chair, that you didn't want the appellate rules or court rules to be dealt with, I mean, not to be affected by this. The specific language here in bottom of page 2 is Superior Court decides that the person isn't eligible for judicial relief. A party may, quote, exercise any right of appeal allowed under law for the final administrative decision as if the person had not filed the petition. That's a very strangely, I'm not going to say strangely drafted, but it's going to cause some problems, at least it would cause me to have some problem, because here what you may be saying is appealing the failure of the court to provide relief. And so as if the party hadn't filed a petition is meaningless, because you're appealing from the decision of the Superior Court. And I don't know how to deal with that. That's why I'm asking Mr. Rozell to come on Friday. I'm sort of just pontificating here on that. I could find the name of that other case if you folks want it.
Okay. Madam Chair, I don't know, this one of the court issue, and I don't want to get all wrapped up in it. It would appear pretty clearly that if the Superior Court decides that they're not eligible for judicial relief under Section A, it just says clearly that the party certainly has its right to continue the administrative process and take any other appeal it has to court. And what Representative Grunberg is talking about, well, gosh, if the Superior Court made a decision that is improper under this statute, and the person also has the right, the way this is written, to take that Superior Court decision up the Superior Court route, but doesn't deny him anything. And so I really find it, I find this is pretty clear. I don't see the problem.
Representative Grunberg on that point?
Yeah, it's the use of the term, quote, right of appeal. And that may be just fine, but you wouldn't necessarily be taking a right of appeal from that. You'd be taking a petition for review. There is no right. The decision of the Superior Court to allow the administrative agency to go forward is not a final decision. So you can't, quote, appeal from that. You can only take a petition for review. And so it's kind of a meaningless phrase. We'll find out from Mr. Rozell and some of these. We fax the thing to him. He'll get some back to us.
Madam Chair, I'll also ask our drafter to give us the interpretation. I know what we intended.
Sure.
And if there's a better way to get there, we're certainly open to that. But we'll get a clarification from our group. Okay.
Good point. Okay, with that, we are adjourned.